This episode of We Are Libertarians is brought to you by Audible.com. Enjoy one free audiobook courtesy of We Are Libertarians. Choose from more than 100,000 audiobook titles, including works by Ron Paul, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard, and the Cato Institute. Audible.com also has audio of radio and TV programs and audio versions of magazines and newspapers. You can get the Audible app on any mobile device or download the audio to your computer. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL or head to WeAreLibertarians.com and find the link to get one free month of Audible today. Welcome to We Are Libertarians for this week. I am your host, Chris Spangle. To my left is Greg Lenz. Greg, how are you?
Doing well, Chris. How are you?
You're a little bit punchy today.
I'm a little bit punchy. I'm a little bit tired, but I've gotten enough caffeine to... I don't even know. I'm basically like the GDP of Colombia and Bolivia right now combined, but I'm going to make it through this.
Explain what you've had to drink.
So far today, I've had 3 venti Pike's Place, each with 2 shots of espresso in it, and then 3 of their energy drinks. But I've got them down. I'm here to go. I was actually feeling very serious, very focused, and then you derailed all that while getting set up for this episode.
I've said too much. Okay, so on the line, you may have heard a little giggle, and that is our buddy Joe Ruiz. Joe, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Oh, I'm good. It's been a while. I don't know when the last time you were on Wall was.
Episode 100, when I was there live.
Oh, that's right. So that's 2 episodes ago. Wink.
And that wasn't so much an episode as audio anarchy. It was an absolute mess.
For 12 or 13 people to be in the room, it was surprisingly well managed. So it didn't come across as just a total free-for-all, but it certainly had its moments.
And Maya made sure that we were all scared to death to act out by walking in the room with a... I think it was an AR-15 unloaded.
Yeah, it was a large gun. What did Mickey think of Maya?
She was frightened by the gun.
Okay.
Yeah, and I work with so many gun businesses and stuff now. I'm used to being around people who are armed. Not necessarily used to having a firearm pointed at me, but used to being around them. It didn't, I don't know, it didn't really pause me, but definitely Mickey was a little scared.
Yeah. Maya, are you guys unfriended? I'm unfriended. I don't know what I did.
I am.
I am not.
You've been unfriended for a while, though, I think, right, Joe?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't check until you said that you were. So.
Oh, okay.
I think I scared Maya out of unfriending me on a private Facebook group that I'm no longer allowed to be a part of. And originally, this group was, and this is a totally separate group from the Brutalists, this group was supposed to be You Could Never Leave It. It was called The Big Plantation.
Okay.
And so there was a race-baiting feminazi that was in the group, and I attacked her. And I think Maya was so shocked by how deep down the rabbit hole I could go when trolling that she didn't dare unfriend me from that point on.
And Joe, when you're not talking, you might mute yourself a little bit because there's a little bit of a whooshy sound.
Okay.
And I don't know if that's us or him, but... Okay, it's gone. All right, good. All right, sounds good. So, yeah, I don't know what happened. Speaking of Facebook groups, we have a Facebook group. It contains some very naughty wall members. some whom, listen, I've already had to tell a couple of these people that they need to just go light themselves on fire.
Dustin Reed specifically.
I like Dustin, but, you know, you can't make fun of us for not doing a podcast. It's been like 8 days or something, hasn't it? I don't know what it's been.
I think it's been probably a couple weeks.
Yeah. So I don't know that we are going to be a weekly podcast, but we're doing the best we can. I mean, our intention is to do this weekly, but it's really hard to...
Things pop up.
Yeah, it's just, you know, to get Greg and I alone in the room together, it's really tough. But, you know, to get a third person, I mean... We're doing this at Friday, you know, at random times just to get Joe Ruiz on here. So
I have largely in part stayed away from that little We Are Libertarians group that you guys started. But I think it's funny that, you know, we're all libertarians and that you set some pretty strict parameters about what would and would not be accepted within the confines of that group. And everybody just breaks the rules anyway. What kind of people we are.
Specifically Greg and I probably more than anybody. Greg released some of the unposted Chris Spangle memes in the in that group.
I think people were a little bit shocked how bad they were.
They're like, oh, who was it, Ryan Connor?
Yeah.
Yeah, Ryan was like, I've been memed by Greg. I was just beaten down and it was so bad. And I was like, here's a meme of me shitting on the hood of a car. You can't talk. This was posted on my Facebook wall.
And then you were a brony.
I was a brony. Many.
Joe knows. Joe's gotten hit by the memes before.
Oh, yeah. They usually involve a sombrero.
They do. Or the most recent one was you became the 4chan grandma.
You look like Baba Booey.
I think everybody in the wall thread at some point has been the 4chan grandma.
It's an honor.
Have
it
you
really
ever made
is.
Yourself the 4chan grandma?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Do you just make memes of yourself?
I've only made like two or three. One, usually it's once I'm being made fun of, I'll make myself Aldo the Apache from Inglourious Basterds.
Okay.
And then tell, you know, it's usually I make myself that and then call myself the Feminazi Hunter.
So you make yourself look good.
Not
Meanwhile,
really.
I'm crapping on the hood of a car.
Well, yeah. My favorite of yous is Richard Simmons.
That is a good one. I was
or maybe
showing,
Marilyn Monroe.
I was showing a coworker these this morning, and I showed that one, and he lost it. My favorite is Rousseau.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Descartes. René Descartes.
And I look like my great-great-great-great-grandfather was Descartes' assistant. So you can find those at my Facebook page. Feel free to try and friend me. I've got like four spaces left. I'm so popular. Or you could go to the wall page. Or if you want to join that group, send Greg or, excuse me, myself a message or send the wall page a message, and we'll hook you up. I think we've actually posted a link to the group on the Facebook page in the last day or two. Today's March 27th. So look for March 26th, I think, of 2015. We posted that link up there. And you can join. The purpose of the group is not to post embarrassing memes of me. It is to help kind of get some feedback on the show, plus just to kind of connect the listeners of Wall and get to know each other.
Of what, you know, we follow pretty specific news sources.
Right.
And so it's, for me, it's good to get as many links as possible from listeners to see what they're interested in hearing about and see if I'm missing things I should be aware of.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So check it out. Join up. Be great. Joe Ruiz, I don't know if you have... I think we plugged it at the end of 100, but let's plug it right here at the beginning when everybody is supposedly still listening to this crap. You do a podcast. We actually put the last episode in the feed. Would you like to tell us about the podcast that is now, you are dangerously close to being the longest running podcast on the WAL radio network besides the mothership here. Uh-oh. Did we kill Joe? Darn it. Well, I guess he can't plug his podcast. That's Hello? Too bad. Nope, too late, Joe. Sorry.
Come on, I had myself muted. You made me do it.
Sorry, man. Time's up.
I'm breaking the rules. Culture and Arts Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Cap Podcast, or you can find us on Facebook at The Cap. We're on iTunes or anywhere else podcasts are available. We're funny. We're topical. Pretty much the best arts and entertainment podcast out there. It needs to be because it belongs to such a rich legacy as is the We Are Libertarians Network.
You know, it is crafted. It takes a long time. It's a bespoke podcast. It's very artisanal. It takes a long time to put these podcasts together. We put a lot of effort into it. At all the podcasts at the WAL Radio Network. You can find it at wal-radio.com. So tell us a little bit more. Who's your co-host?
Jason Merle is the name of my co-host. He lives here in South Bend, Indiana, right down the street. And we just get together and talk about whatever's happening in the arts and entertainment world. We are going to record an episode tomorrow. I think the last time, you know, we just talked about our jury duty experiences because we both ironically got called for jury duty on the same weeks during the same day. And we both were selected for our jury panels. I kind of did a big, long 11-page write-up on WeAreLibertarians.com. And he shared a little bit more about his experience during that episode, which was episode 25, I think. So it's one of those podcasts where it's really anything we want it to be. One week it can be, you know, dirty and filthy, and we can talk about all sorts of scoundrelly and sexual things. One week we can talk about something very serious that's happening in the scope of media or film. Some days we can get a nerd boner about comic book films. Some days we can talk politics, and that's what we did last time. Tomorrow, I think we're going to go on a rage about Tinder and online dating.
So it sounds like the Obsessive Viewer podcast, only better.
Only better, because...
That's a total inside joke. One of our friends does the inside... I know he listens. I'm sure he listens. The Obsessive Viewer podcast. Check it out, and I'm just giving him crap. But, yeah, so you're going to talk about Tinder and dating, and let me tell you, online dating, an enormous waste of time, Joe.
Well, yeah, and I agree. And I've heard that from you, and I've heard that from Jason, who's tried it. And what we're going to do, basically, is... because we can and because we have nothing better to do, is we're just going to run down a long list of female celebrities, and we're going to decide whether we would swipe them left or right. And Jason has a story that kind of correlates to that. It was inspired by a recent video that they did. It was the Game of Thrones cast, and they were being interviewed by someone who was, you know, using Tinder, and he was saying, in regards to your castmates, would you swipe left or would you swipe right? And just getting, you know, the feel for how each castmate felt about the next person. So we decided to do that for ourselves.
Why not add some guys in there, Joe? Why do you got to be so sexist and do only women?
Because I'm totally sexist and not attracted to men at all.
Well, no, that's...
No, I'm
that's
not
true.
Really sexist. But
no, I meant the attracted to men part. See, I love having Joe on because we pick on him all the time, and
not so much we as you. But...
Oh yeah, yeah. That's because I love Joe.
I do have fans out there.
I know.
Araya Torres is going to listen to this. My boy Izzy is going to listen to this, and they're going to say, "Why are they picking on my guy Joe?" You're going to get some mean messages. Watch.
I think I might be Aria Aurora. What's her name?
Aurora Borealis.
We screwed it up.
I know. I'm just screwing around. All right. That's for her benefit. But, yeah, you do have some fans. I do get a lot of comments. Like, when's Joe coming back on? Always shocks us.
No, I'd probably done more episodes with Joe than you at this point, just because during your hiatus, yeah. We did quite a few, and those were. I mean, I still up at Michigan. That was one of the most fun podcasts I've ever done in my adult life.
I know when I was on the Lost Weekend after the divorce, I was kind of like, oh, I just can't do it. We've got to put something up. We can't just stop the podcast because I hate that. You like a podcast and you listen for a long time, and then they just disappear. You know, they do like a year and a half of episodes, and then they're gone. And you know, this is too much fun for us to ever stop doing it. It's sort of like, what is that thing, that group? You can't leave.
Oh, yeah, the Big Plantation.
Yeah.
Well, that's not in fact true, because I was blocked.
Well, let's not call this the Big Plantation. We might make Joe uncomfortable.
Okay.
So we... All right.
It's already on this episode.
Yeah. What?
I said so many inside jokes on this episode already.
I know. We can't tell any of you any of it either. But, you know, so when I was on the Lost Weekend and then, like, I was putting my life back together and I couldn't do it. And you guys did a string of episodes and I listened to almost all of them and I just was like, you know, I'm so lucky that, you know, I met Joe and Greg specifically. Peffer's less, but... You know, and Creighton, too, like, I'm, like, the least integral part of the podcast, except for the fact that I have all the passwords. So
and you're dear leader.
Yeah, I'm dear leader. And you guys did a great job hosting. It's like, man, there's five or six people involved in this whole project that could step up and host a podcast and do, if you go to wal-radio.com. We don't have any active, other than the Cat Podcast, we don't have any other active podcasts. Maya has gone on her merry way. Gina has dropped off the face of the earth. The Shill Report, which can be found in the back episodes of this feed, I thought was a good podcast because Joe and I were on it, and Ryan Ripley was there too. And the Shill Report for 14 strong episodes talked about, you know, the business of journalism, because I think journalism is every bit as important as the government in shaping perception, and I saw a big example of this week. And that... go ahead, Joe.
No, I was just... Well, there was an incident in the pro wrestling world. Me being a pro wrestling fan, it was kind of a big deal. There was a very, very popular Hispanic Latin superstar down in Mexico wrestling for the AAA promotion. He did a small indie show. His name was Pedro Aguayo Jr., and his father was like one of the biggest Mexican wrestling names. Well, anyway, Rey Mysterio Jr., who is like a big Latin star in America, was recently released from his WWE contract, and he went down for a small indie show down there with three other wrestlers. It was a tag match, and somewhere within the course of this match, he dropkicked this guy. A couple moves later, the guy kind of fell on the ropes and passed out. They pushed him to make sure he didn't have a concussion and that he wasn't unconscious, but basically the guy died. And they had video of this guy dying in the middle of his match, this big star. And so the next thing you know, the Associated Press and several other sites on the internet were reporting that Rey Mysterio, fresh off of his WWE release, had killed his friend and his longtime colleague, Pero Aguayo, when there is no evidence in the video or elsewhere to show that he did anything wrong or, you know, outside of his skill set or, you know, anything inappropriate.
It's a lot like the Tony Stewart crash. I mean, Tony Stewart is sick over the young man that died in the sprint racing accident that he was involved in. And, you know, he didn't intentionally kill a guy, but, you know. Okay.
If anyone in racing was gonna be accused of intentionally killing a guy, it's Tony Stewart, and that's from years of building and cultivating that persona.
He's a little bit more mellow than he used to be. I once hit Tony Stewart in the face with a microphone out at the track when I worked there, and I was turning around trying to listen to a coworker, and I booped him right in the nose with the microphone, and he goes, "Hey, watch it there, bud."
And but you were fearful.
This is the week after he punched a guy. He didn't take me out. He could have. I'm a weak man. I am not strong. I cannot fight. I cannot go to prison, Joe. Don't tell anybody what I've told you.
If you ain't first, you're last.
So, you know, and this applies to, we talked about it with Hillary Clinton in the last episode about the press, but here in Indiana, we are experiencing a large, there's a controversy surrounding our state, mainly because we have 100 old white assholes in charge of our government that are making us look terrible, and we could lose a lot of convention business. So let's give you a little context to this Mike Pence story, signing this bill about discrimination and religious freedom, and we're going to talk about some of the religious freedom bills that are going around the country. And talk about Indiana, because we have a lot of Indiana listeners, despite being a national show at this point, an international show. We're heard in like 7 or 8 countries, even Canada. And well, they're our sworn enemy.
I don't know if I like that aspect.
There's
of
like
it.
4 Canadian listeners, and I'm sure they're all just taking notes, adding it to the dossier as they plot against us. By the way, the Canadian thing, it's a joke that it's so stupid to hate other people because they're from another nation. It's a joke. It's an inside joke about nationalism. We don't actually hate Canadians. Please stop hating on our Facebook wall if you don't get the joke.
Or do and just expect to be trolled.
Right. Yeah, we love the people in our Facebook group, and we love the people that listen to this podcast. The people that comment on our Facebook page don't listen to the podcast, so they don't get some of the inside jokes, which maybe we should change our style and, you know, be more, I don't know, like Raw Story or Politico.
That's boring.
Nah, never mind. F that. We're just going to be ourselves, and if you don't get it, too bad.
Facebook page could just get a sense of humor.
Right. Politico should post memes of Glenn Thrush and Mike Allen. That's what they ought to do.
Get more page views, that's for sure.
Yeah. So here's a little context to Indiana. And then we'll talk about the story specifically. So Indiana has long been, you know, a Midwestern state. In 2008, even, in a state of 6 million people, 2 million of which live in the center of the state, where Greg and I are, Joe lives up in South Bend near the Michigan border, South Bend area, let's say. And Indiana is shifting from an industrial and agrarian society to more of what most of the rest of the nation is shifting to, idea jobs, you know, idea factories, innovation jobs.
It's the rise of the creative class.
Exactly right. And because we have Purdue here, which is a fantastic technical school.
Rose Holman,
both, you know, think MIT, think Caltech, think Stanford. only for the Midwest. Purdue is largely known as one of the best agriculture and agricultural schools, but also engineering. Rose Holman is a local engineering school. And, you know, previous governors, especially Mitch Daniels, have worked hard to try and bring a lot of tech jobs to Indiana because we've got these two schools that can draw people here. Had a lot of great, we have a thriving tech community that Greg is fairly involved with. You know, we've got ExactTarget was started here, which has become a major company.
FormStack?
FormStack.
That Primo got bought. Yeah. We've got Interactive Intelligence. Mm-hmm. The other big ones are going to, they're more on the rise, but Lessonly is a big one that's going to be a competitor to, it's a corporate training software. It's a startup that I'd plug. Tinderbox is a software. It's basically a sales proposal software as a service system that's really taking off and great. We just, you know, we have a lot of blossoming enterprise tech companies because that's really been the focus. You're not going to hear about Indy as a competitor like Austin, Silicon Valley, or Boulder, but
where you get a lot of social media.
That's
the
thing,
and
is you get the
startups.
Consumer. Yeah, you get the consumer, the two consumer apps and ecosystem. But here we have wonderful. I mean, Blackboard, the major competitors for universities to provide online learning platforms,
education software, and so Indiana has a lot of tech companies for biotech companies.
Tons
of biotech companies because of Lilly and all the device makers up in the Warsaw area around Fort Wayne, which is sort of kind of around Ohio, Toledo-ish area, if you don't know where Fort Wayne is. And also, like Greg said, enterprise, meaning business startups. So, you know, we have been able in Indiana to distinguish ourselves and attract people and try and draw talent to our state to give us jobs in a high-growth sector. And
arguably the only growth sector in the economy.
Yeah. When we are going through a change where, you know, in a state of 6 million people, 700,000 jobs were tied to the auto industry five years ago, you know, and obviously the auto industry, all the, you just drive up 31 between here and where we are and Joe in the South Bend area, that whole corridor up the central area of the state where, you know, Chrysler, Ford, Chevy had a lot of suppliers, and there was a Chrysler plant here in Indianapolis that shut down a few years ago. Rolls-Royce and Allison's, a transmission and an engine maker.
International Harvester.
Are here, but, you know, obviously investment doesn't come here. So we're a state undergoing a serious economic shift. And, you know, our previous governor worked really hard to bring a lot of high-tech jobs, and he also brought jobs like the Honda plant.
To Subaru,
and many other jobs. And Mitch Daniels, who is now president of Purdue, that tech firm, that great computer sciences, great engineering school that we talked about up in West Lafayette, who on the Forbes World Influencers list released like today, Mitch is on there.
He is, you know, the thing about Mitch is people can, you know, a lot of the social justice warrior left in Indiana didn't like him because he had a reputation as when he was head of the budget in D.C. as the blade because he cut everything. But Mitch is the most pragmatic politician in America. He comes into Indiana. He looks at it and he says, "Oh, you know, this is either going to be incredibly painful or we can get out in front and lead this transition." And so you have Mitch that's going. I mean, I don't know of an Indiana governor that made trips to China in order to court, tech companies, brings them over here, and then also focuses Indiana on the logistics industry, which was one of the other high growth industries, transitions the economy, gets things set up, and then here from D.C. comes good old Mike Pence.
Good old Mike Pence. And, you know, Daniels lists amongst his most top, like, five influential books as Charles Murray's What It Means to Be a Libertarian. Eric Holcomb was his chief of staff, his campaign manager, his, I don't know if he's campaign manager, he might have been, and his Indiana State GOP chairman. He just announced that he's running for Dan Coats' Senate seat, so you can find out more about Eric. Obviously, as a libertarian, I'm not going to vote for Eric, but I will say
Of all the Republicans,
Holcomb and Mitch Daniels, in my time as head of the Libertarian Party of Indiana, were always exceedingly decent to me. I know that Andy, who ran against Mitch Daniels in 2004, really respected Mitch, and Mitch treated him with a lot of respect. They made sure they reached out to us to make sure that we were included in the gubernatorial debates both times. You know, they were always very respectful of our place. And I'm not saying that Mitch was a libertarian. I'm not saying that he always did everything right according to libertarians, but, you know, he put the focus on fiscal issues.
He's core a pragmatist.
And if Republicans were more like Mitch Daniels, it probably, you just push her off. My cat's sitting on Greg. He's not a fan. Now, there was a point in 2011, October-ish, 2011, when Mitch Daniels made a comment on one of his Meet the Press appearances, I think it was, you know, we've got to focus the soul of the party. I think he was releasing his book, and there was kind of the 2012 talk was kind of swirling around Mitch Daniels, who ultimately decided not to run, who said, you know, the party needs to focus on fiscal issues and not social issues. And that was the force of his book, Keeping the Republic. And Mike Pence, who was then the 6th District Congressional Representative and now our current governor, came out and jabbed a hot poker right in Mitch Daniels' eye and said, you know, he couldn't be more wrong. It was something along the lines of the greatest economic impact. The best thing that we can do for Indiana's economy is make sure that the Indiana family is strong. He is a total, he's like George Bush, but without the substance. with worse writers.
Oh, that is an administration completely devoid of talent.
So, you know, Mike Pence thinks that a strong family is the key to economics, and it may be. I'm not arguing that. But I don't think that's the place of any politician to try and manage a family and who stays together and who gets married and who doesn't, because that's folly. It doesn't work. And so when Mike Pence ran in 2012, he was very careful to not be photographed or seen with anybody who was with the Indiana Family Institute or Advance America, like Eric Miller, Micah Clark, Kurt Smith. Any of those folks. He didn't want to be seen with the culture warriors. And he just time and time again said he was going to carry on the tradition of Mitch Daniels and focus on fiscal issues, and tax cuts were going to be his priority, and strengthening business and getting jobs to Indiana. His tagline and slogan for Indiana, and I think it's our travel slogan or something, is a state that works. And Mike Pence was very choreographed and careful not to let it slip that he was going to do what he did, which is step in a giant pile of family values. And I will say this, Mike Pence is an absolutely genuine person when it comes to family values. I can tell you that there are many politicians in Indiana that I have seen personally. I've witnessed their behavior. They say one thing about family values and they do another. We all have those politicians. Mike Pence is, in regards to his family and to his faith and to what he believes, I have found him to be an absolute genuine person, and I've never heard one rumor or anything in regards to Mike Pence not being exactly what he says he is. So I will give him that credit. But, because there's always a giant but, when there's gay rights involved. There, at the beginning of every Indiana General Assembly, Brian Bosma, who is our Speaker of the House, looks at the Republican caucus, of which there is a supermajority in the House, a supermajority in the Senate, and now the governor's office
And
here
the Democrats
Indiana.
Are Republicans.
Very conservative. In 2012, it was John Gregg, the Democrat, who did not support gay marriage, barely supported civil unions. Mike Pence, say no more, and Rupert Bonham, the tie-dye survivor guy who I worked with and is a good friend, who was the first candidate of any party in the gubernatorial history of Indiana to support LGBT rights outright. So, very conservative state when it comes to family values. It,
like, if you put John Gregg in California, he'd be billed as a right-wing reactionary.
Totally. Yeah, he'd be a Republican.
But, like, way worse. Like, he'd be the worst Republican in the history of the California Republic.
Well, I'm sure there's plenty of awful Republicans, but yeah, you're pretty much dead on. So there's supermajorities in all the chambers and obviously a conservative Supreme Court here in Indiana. Despite it nearly going Democrat in the presidential races, it's a very conservative state. And, you know, Brian Bosma has instituted a point system in his caucus to control his caucus. Now, we're kind of taking a long time to get to the point, but I think it's an interesting study for listeners to kind of understand how our state works. So maybe it gives you some context to how your state might work and how politics works in general. But Brian Bosma is a very powerful speaker of the House in Indiana and in many ways more powerful than the governor himself. He's been here a very long time. And when he got the majority and became the speaker of the House and just as head of his caucus when he was minority leader as well for a brief period, he instituted a point system, and he said, if you are going to be a part of this caucus, at some point you will run into trouble. You will do something, you will have a tough race, and we're going to try and figure out where we need to spend our resources. Now, granted, we've gerrymandered out of the 150 seats in the General Assembly in both the House and Senate, there's really only like 20% of the races that are actually competitive. Because no one runs, someone from the other party doesn't run, or it's just a runaway for one of the two parties. It's very highly gerrymandered in the General Assembly. But someone always does kind of get in trouble, or redistricting comes around every 10 years, and sometimes two representatives find themselves in the same district, and the caucus has to choose who they're going to support in slating. And if you haven't earned enough points by fundraising, carrying water on some bills, making certain votes, doing certain things that garner points, a favor system with the rest of the caucus, you can find yourself outside of the caucus. As Senator Waterman, who inexplicably Americans for Prosperity voted out Senator Waterman, who was, you know, for Americans for Prosperity to claim that they're a libertarian group and then work against Senator Waterman, who was an independent thinking Republican and would at least listen to libertarians on some issues, to work against him and put in an established Republican just was mystifying to me until I really thought about it and thought, oh yeah, it's because he doesn't do what the caucus says. And
he's unpredictable.
So there's one guy named Bruce Borders who's an Elvis impersonator. I shit you not. He was one of the guys who was speaking out for this. Scott Schneider, who's a hardcore conservative. You know, these guys, they're at the beginning of every session, Brian Bosma looks at that caucus and says, don't do anything crazy. And by anything crazy, he means don't embarrass the caucus and don't introduce bills that are going to make us look crazy or just look bad in the press, mostly dealing with social issues. We've had the gay marriage amendment where we're putting into the Constitution that marriage is between a man and a woman. That has finally died. That doesn't exist. In Indiana, that's not going to pass ever. Because by the time it's allowed to come up again in a couple of years, society's going to be even more against putting discrimination into our state constitution. And so now they're kind of, because they've got super majorities, they're all in protection mode on the social conservative side. So they want to pander to their base, raise money. The Indiana Family Institute and the other social conservative groups want to raise money. And so they kind of needed some red meat issues to raise money because they're not going to have the gay marriage amendment to use anymore. And so they introduced a bill that you've heard the stories a million times. The Christian Baker, or here in Indianapolis, we had an instance where a gay group from IUPUI wanted some cookies or a cake made for their, I think it was cookies, made for their group, and they wanted rainbows painted on them, and they went to Just Cookies in the city market, which is in downtown Indianapolis, and which is a public facility, and they said, here's what we want, and the group, and Just Cookies said, I'm sorry, we can't do that because we're Christians, we're devout, and it would be against our religion to make these cookies for you. And they eventually, I believe, went out of business. And because they're in a city facility, there was some talk about pulling them out of the group, but I don't think that ever happened. But obviously, they faced a lot of public backlash as an organization, to the point that, you know, they were across the street from my office, and I went and talked to them about 6 months after everything happened, and I asked how things were, and they said, we've never recovered, and we're probably going to shut down soon, because we got such bad press that it irrevocably hurt our business, and we can't survive. And I said, did you make the right choice? And they said, no, I don't think we did, business-wise, but personally, morally, probably. You know, we'll just figure out something else to do and we'll move on. It's, you know, we stood for our principles, and at the end of the day, you have to feel comfortable with that. So, you know, that's what happens in these situations. Nobody needed to sue anybody, you know.
The market is amoral. The market,
right,
doesn't
the market
respect
doesn't
morality.
Care. Right. But because we need to fundraise for our sides, meaning... grab your guns, pick your side, start shooting by writing us a check. We have this bill. And this freedom of religion bill went through the House, went through the Senate, got passed, went to Governor Pence, and Governor Pence signed it a few days ago. Now, we'll get into the details of the bill in here in just a second, but the outrage that has been sparked has been tremendous, to the point that the mayor of San Francisco says that no one from the city is allowed to travel to Indianapolis to participate in our conventions. One of the ways that Indianapolis has distinguished itself from other Rust Belt cities, other Midwestern cities, is that we have a large convention center. We have built, with taxpayer money, a large stadium, Lucas Oil Stadium, I think like doubled, tripled, quadrupled the size of our convention center.
Yeah.
And have really placed a big bet as a city over the last 30 years on convention businesses and pro sports and drawing people here. The NBA,
NFL Combine.
And the NFL Combine
we
here.
Super Bowl.
We have
the Final Four roughly every
we
third
have,
year.
We have the Final Four this week. The NCAA is headquartered here. And so sports, there was even an Olympics package that was being put together at some point. They keep bidding on the Super Bowl again, but it's kind of been hinted at the city that now we're not coming there. And the NCAA is considering whether or not they'll continue to have the Final Four here. Now, you know...
And even be headquarters here.
Yeah. Salesforce.com is a major enterprise business, a ton of business contacts, a ton of tech contacts. They acquired a company called ExactTarget, which was a star of the Indiana tech community, an email service, think MailChimp, think Constant Contact, and it became Salesforce Cloud Marketing. And they have a lot of staff here. And their CEO made a point of sending a letter to the governor saying that if you sign this, we have major investment plans for Indiana that we've discussed with your administration. We'll cancel that if you sign this bill. And he signed it. And Salesforce sent out a tweet, their CEO sent out a tweet saying, we're canceling our plans, we're not, you know, necessary travel only. I mean, it really is, the way that it has been reacted, it's like, unless there's an emergency, we're not going to Indiana. Because everybody there has, like, this awful plague of
social conservatism.
You know, I think everybody here at anybody that listens to this podcast knows that we are all, you know, we don't agree with social conservatism at all. You know, I'm sure there are listeners of ours who are, you know,
wrong,
who are social conservatives. You know, there are also people who may just be personally conservative. They're libertarian. I mean, I'm a personally conservative person. I'm a Christian. Although if I were faced with the question of whether or not to make somebody a gay cake or not for their gay wedding, I would make them a cake because, in my view, it does not show compassion or love towards another human being to deny them a cake. Do you know what I mean? Like, opening a voluntary exchange and dialogue with somebody is more compassionate and more loving and more, you know, like...
To me,
if a Christian says, I'm not going to associate with sinners... It is so stupid because...
It's anti-Christian.
Yeah, because everybody's a Christian according to Christian scripture. Homosexual acts are considered the same level of sin as sex outside of marriage. So if an engaged couple walks in to buy their wedding cake, do you ask them if they had sex before marriage?
Yes, you should.
You should, and you should get it on tape and like start a website. You'll do twice as good as the cake business.
Yes, you will.
But my point is you don't walk in and like if you are a Christian cake maker that is devout enough to cancel a cake, you consider homosexuality a sin. So are you asking all your customers their quote-unquote sin? Like, do you? I hope I'm getting this out correctly and representing the question correctly, and not people aren't like saying, oh, Spangle thinks that gay people are sinners, all that kind of, you know. But I just don't find the Christian cake maker to be consistent in their ideology, and sort of it's just a weird stance.
It's an extremely odd stance, and it's one of those stances to me that makes it seem like they were out looking for a fight.
Yeah.
Because when did, like, we have a long-standing tradition, supposedly in the United States, of not infusing, the state and religion, separation of church and state.
Yeah, Quakers in a time of draft, for instance.
Yeah.
Religious exemptions.
But I've said this before, but I mean, outside of higher education being the official state religion of the United States, commerce always takes precedence of any state entity, any belief. I mean, who would ever be against the private industry in the United States? That is the, you know, everyone loves pro-jobs, pro-America, pro-growth. And to the fact that you would, if you can't compartmentalize those two aspects of your life, of being able to separate church and commerce, why are you an advocate of separation of church and state?
Religion is an exercise in individual, I mean, to me, the best analogy, and this is going to piss you off, Craig, the best analogy of religion comes in the concept of the greater jihad in Islam, where the concept of the greater jihad is that you are constantly going to war with yourself and going to battle with your own urges and thoughts, and it has nothing to do with anybody else but yourself. Like, to me, being a Christian is about studying the Word, studying the Bible, going to church, thinking about my own behavior and trying to live the golden rule as best as I can. I don't sit here and examine Greg's life and say, Greg, Joe, you guys really need to stop this behavior or this act, or you need to do this or blah, 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 because you need to do this. I mean, it's the exact opposite of the plank in your eye. I mean, to me, religion is an expression. It is about... I mean, I can understand why some people want to you want to make culture as Christian as possible or as Islamic as possible, whatever. But you really, Christians have lost on this issue. The evangelical church has killed themselves on this issue because they come across as completely unloving, uncompassionate, inconsiderate,
theocrats,
judgmental theocrats, completely. And
the General Assembly has actually done the killing of them, I guess, I think you put it. And the Christians or any other religious peoples who supported it have kind of shot themselves in the foot because they think that the ends justifies the means. But the ends is actually that there's like a greater negative perception about their faith. And somebody called me a fool last night on Facebook because I said that what's more important than this law for what it may or may not be, and it was very divisive. You know, everybody was talking about it. Everybody had their opinion out there. But I said that the perception of the law matters because most people are pretty casual about politics, and that can translate to being uninformed or whatever. And I think that it's pretty safe to say in 2015, more people are going to listen to Miley Cyrus calling Governor Pence an asshole and running with that then for them to do any sort of heavy-handed research themselves. They're going to focus on Huffington Post deadlines in their news feeds. They're going to focus on pair that with the official pictures that Pence put out with him seated at his desk, and he's in the company of nuns and priests and rabbis and monks and pastors and prophets and Tim Wesko and Sister Mary Clarence from Sister Act or whatever. that's the kinds of things that people are going to No, and it's going to not just shape their opinion of the law, but it's going to shape or create a new perception or I guess further a negative perception about religious peoples. And if I'm a religious person, the aim of most religious people is evangelism. It's outreach. It's recruitment. If you're a non-believer who sees that religious people have used the law and it's perceived to be discriminatory, whether it's not or whatever your argument may be, if it's perceived to be discriminatory, it now makes it even harder for you as a religious person to convert your casual audience. And it just further stigmatizes religion.
Completely. Could not agree with you more, Joe. You're absolutely right. You know, and so this was a hill that, you know, I'm reading the Steve Jobs book, and Steve Jobs wasn't a religious person. But, you know, he said, you know, my problem with Christians is that they try to be socially conservative. They try to tell everybody else how to live, and they get totally lost when they do that. The best part of Christianity, I'm most attracted to Christianity when Christians talk about how to live a better life and how to live like Jesus. So that's my advice for the Christian community. Now let's get to my problem with the gay community. I have a problem with everybody in this. if anybody has any complaints that they'd like,
you are treading on dangerous, dangerous.
No, either everybody's going to like me or nobody's going to like me at the end of this.
Well,
podcast.
Well, everyone's going to hate you.
Good.
Before you send all of our gay fans away, can I just say one more thing about the Christians before we get off of them?
And then would you like to plug the Cat Podcast?
Oh, my gosh. I don't mean to send you over. I'm sorry. I just wanted to put in there before we moved on that I think it's far more important to tend to, like, the inner workings of the church if you're a religious person and the communities on, like, a person-to-person basis than it is to chase down laws that are going to, like, insulate us and, you know, air quotes, protect us. Because, like, with this, when we focus on stuff like legislation as opposed to just loving the guy next to us, we kind of further alienate the people that we're really trying to get to. And for a Christian or any other religious person, I'd say the best tool we have is like an individual with a kind heart who cares about the people next to him. And whether Christians or anyone else see this bill as a victory or not, I think it's far more likely going to paint the church as a political lobby than it is going to like assist with, you know, the Great Commission or whatever the equivalent concept in another religion would be.
Right. Greg?
In the grand scheme of things, so, and what this bill actually did was it created a protected class, much like the Civil Rights Act, out of Christians. Because essentially, granted, everybody's protected, you know, under Article 1 of the Indiana Constitution, everyone is protected, but what this did is it treated, what it does is treats Christians like a protective class. It's fundamentally no different than affirmative action of legal or affirmative action and legal protection for Christians in Indiana from legal prosecution from defendants, but that it will not have that effect because you can't exempt somebody from a lawsuit. So if I own Just Cookies and I don't want to sell them rainbow cookies, they can file a lawsuit regardless or not of this legislation. As a business owner, I can either take two stands. I can say on principle, I'm going to fight you. And I can tell you right now that the gay rights organizations will line up to fund their lawsuit. So I'm going to have to go to war and hope to God that I can somehow fund my legal defense, stay in business, and operate my company. So I realistically can either go bankrupt or I can cave and settle out of court. All this is going to do is this is going to make every single one of these lawsuits settle out of court. Yeah. It will not protect anyone because you will never be able to withstand the amount of money and funds that will get behind the gay community and their lawsuits. They are very passionate about their cause, and to them, all this did was legalize and codify discrimination. So they are constantly on the lookout. And Christian organizations, yes, maybe they'll come to the aid of the business owner.
Oh, the hell yeah.
They will.
They will. Hell yeah.
But here's the thing is, Creighton made a point earlier this week that what this does is ultimately it will identify those that are bigoted and drive them out of business because it puts it out in the press that they are legally protected from refusing to sell cookies to a gay community if it's considered a reasonable encumbrance. Which, why would you ever want to leave let a governing body decide what is a reasonable encumbrance to your religion? you're just
define encumbrance, please.
So, like, if you slaughter, if you're, let's say you're, I mean, just to give me, and this sounds horrible, but like an Old Testament example, let's say that your religion requires you to sacrifice your first son on a mountain on a, you know, that is not considered reasonable by any definition legally. You're not allowed to slaughter your firstborn son in the name of your religion and have protection under the under U.S. and Indiana law. But in this case, what is defined as reasonable...
Unless you operate drones for the U.S. military, then it's okay.
Well, the government's always exempt from all of this.
Oh, okay, good.
Right. They're exempt. They're not going to be... They have no religious encumbrances at all. Like, you know, whatever. But so in this case, you've set a standard now that being able to deny cookies violates your religious principles. And it's not a whole lot different than the Quakers in the draft. And since they're pacifists, and so, but now we're going down a rabbit hole of legal interpretation, and you're leaving it up to elected officials who ultimately put before the Indiana Supreme Court who is going to make the ultimate decision anyway. And so it's not like it's a really, it's not blind law, you know, it's not blind justice, because to say that the Indiana Supreme Court is blind to, you know, their personal individual beliefs and their interpretations of law, you've just taken this law and put it in their hands and allow them to define reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, Mark Massa was worked for the Daniels administration, then ran for prosecutor of Marion County as a Republican, and now he's on the Supreme Court appointed by Mitch Daniels. So it's not like he's, you know, a totally impartial person. Anybody who watches the judicial system knows that It's not impartial.
It's not true justice. It's not a true, you know, balance and scales. And so what all this has done is because this entire thing's about politics. And it goes back to a grander theme of something we talked about this week. The race for 2016 for the Republican nomination has all of a sudden become who can accumulate the most evangelicals in their camp.
Yeah.
And I jokingly referred to it as a religious dick measuring contest. And that's what it seems like it is to me, because I look at this shaping up and I see Ted Cruz, I see Mike Huckabee, I see Rick Santorum, I see now Mike Pence, I see, I'm shocked Michelle Bachmann hasn't thrown her name into the ring. You just have all these evangelical Christians acting like this is the only voting bloc. Mike Pence is going to run. It won't be a real run because he's Mitt Romney in 2008. He just needs to get name and brand exposure. So he's going to run. This is going to be his springboard into the fight for the evangelicals in the 2016 primary. He knows he isn't going to win. He knows it's damaging. And it shows that he is, at his core, a politician and not a governor, not a statesman in any way, shape, or form. Because Mitch Daniels, switch roles, laughs in the face of his
If Brian Bosma had brought this bill to his desk, Mitch Daniels would have told him to get the out of
his
office.
He would have hired a private investigator, looked at every aspect of his private life, and leaked all of it to the Indy Star.
It wouldn't have been him, but it would have been... I shouldn't say anything on tape.
It wouldn't have been him, but it would have been someone around him, and... I mean, it would have been Frank Underwood.
No, here's the problem with before we get mad at everybody, let me yell at the Daniels administration or the Pence administration. Daniels had a great working relationship with the Indiana General Assembly Republicans, both on the House and Senate side, for the most part. He had very skilled people. When Daniels came into office, Daniels said, "I want to hire the best and the brightest for my cabinet, for my staff. You know, public service is something to aspire to. Nothing is more important than serving the people of Indiana." He made his Commerce Secretary, Mickey Maurer, his Commerce Secretary. The guy was a hardcore Democrat, funder, owned a ton of stuff, radio stations that I later worked for. Made a Democrat his Cabinet Secretary for Commerce in Indiana, who largely brought a lot of business to the state, because he said Mickey Maurer is one of the smartest businessmen in this state, and he's willing to serve, and we can work together. It doesn't matter that we're on a different side. So Mitch Daniels valued, he didn't care, he wanted a variety of people, a variety of backgrounds, of good connections, of good stock, who could come in and serve the state. Did he always do the right thing? Absolutely not. But I always respect when people value diversity of thought. Mike Pence has a cabinet and an administration and advisors that look like him, that think like him, that say the same things as him, and when he comes up with an idea, they say, that is great. Good job. And as a result, he has closed ranks and has always closed ranks around him. He has hired his friends. He has hired people that think like him and will tell him what he wants to hear and that never challenge him on a single thing. And so now it's biting him in the ass because he's not hired competent people. He's hired incompetent people. He has had no success in the Indiana General Assembly because he has no relationship with the Indiana General Assembly because nobody in the party. Did you notice now, conveniently, Mitch Daniels takes a job that the Purdue Board of Directors told him he couldn't get involved in politics. And so he couldn't help Mitch Daniels, or he couldn't help Mike Pence in his race for governor to succeed him. And it's curious that none of Mitch Daniels' people helped the Mike Pence administration. Nobody who worked in the Daniels administration went on to work for the Mike Pence administration.
Carried over, yeah.
Why is that? Is that because one was a different breed than the other? Absolutely. Was that because the closed ranks didn't want that diversity of thought and that openness? Absolutely. And so you've got the Mike Pence news service that comes out, where Mike Pence is going to start his own news service.
The Pence Report.
The Pence Report. And now you've got this ridiculous social conservative bill that does nothing to help small business owners, and it does nothing but drive industry away from Indianapolis and Indiana at large. I don't understand what he's doing and what he's thinking. It just has to be gross incompetence. And we started off talking about the press. Mike Pence, for a guy who worked in talk radio and had pretty good relations with many of the members of the press in this state because he was friendly with all of them, he was syndicated across Indiana on WIBC. A guy named Greg Garrison now takes his place, a very conservative lawyer who interviewed Mike Pence, the only interview that Mike Pence has given about this until after he signed the bill. Mike Pence was challenged by Greg Garrison as to why we even needed this bill. Mike Pence has barely talked to a single reporter. Mitch Daniels used to hold weekly meetings off and on the record with the Indiana press, had a great relationship with all of them. Mike Pence has not carried on that tradition, has not built a relationship with the press, has been hostile to the press, and his communication staff has mostly been totally incompetent. And the press has written about it at every step and complained about it at every step. Mike Pence doesn't give them anything of substance. He gives them platitudes and talking points. And so you know what the press does when Mike Pence gets in a jam? Mike Pence doesn't have the relationship to talk to any of them. Mike Pence doesn't have the ability to have a conversation with them about what he's planning or what he's doing. He just lets it leak or drops it. And so what do? It isn't Mike Pence administration revamp state press release website. It's Mike Pence starts his own news service.
He starts the Hoosier Pravda.
Right. It isn't Mike Pence to sign bill that protects small business owners. It's Mike Pence supports discriminating against gay people. And so you know what that does? I don't give a shit about Mike Pence, clearly. I don't care about Mike Pence. But what Mike Pence has done is he's now going to make the Indiana taxpayers pay more taxes, because now we're going to lose the revenue from Gen Con, from Exact Target, from all of these Indiana businesses that are not going to stay here. They're not going to keep their convention business here. They're not going to invest further in their business here. He's hurt the Hoosiers because he wants to run for president, and he wants to be a social conservative, and he wants to put his personal goals ahead of the people of Indiana, and he's an absolute scumbag for it.
And let me say, because you're going to get the individual like, well, that's Mark Benioff, that's just one company. You know, there's plenty more that'll come in here. Mark Benioff was vice president of operations at Oracle, Larry Ellison funded, which was a CIA project that went on to become, now he's what, the third wealthiest man in America.
Sort of like Peter Thiel funding the backbone
Prism. So basically, Larry Oracle could buy Peter Thiel about 60 times. He's that rich. And so this is a guy that Mark Benioff was invested in and was one of his employees. This goes on to Tim Cook, CEO at Apple. which goes back to Kleiner Perkins, which is the most successful venture capital fund in the United States. Right now they've got some issues with a lawsuit for sexism, but John Doerr at Kleiner Perkins owns all of tech in the world. He is the most connected, influential individual on the planet. When Hillary Clinton wanted to run in 2008, that's who she contacted, and he got Steve Jobs, Larry Ellison, Mark Benioff, all of them in a room, all together at the same time. This is the guy that is never talked about in the press. You won't see $1 of technical venture capital come into Indiana after this law. The reason why? They funded PayPal. PayPal, Peter Thiel. PayPal, Elon Musk. Jeremy Stoppelman, CEO at Yelp, Angie's List, greatest competitor. Max Levchin, who started Slide, and then was the original co-founder of PayPal. You're talking about ramifications that will be so dangerous to the Indiana economy, it's hard to overstate. Because if those dollars don't come here, nothing will. They control biotech, they control green tech, they control everything outside of automotive. And automotive has one leader, and that's Elon Musk, who is tied back to that as well. You are literally talking about the absence of investment in Indiana for new companies to grow and scale and hire new people in its entirety.
Yeah, and the convention business, which Indianapolis has gone all in on, that is their hope to grow and build the core of the city, and that is the tax base. That is how we fund all the stuff that we've built. So the taxpayers of Indiana and Indianapolis have built all of these convention centers and all these little improvements to the city to handle the load that comes with all these conventions. And now we're not going to be able to attract those conventions because it's a PR nightmare. Because what has happened is it doesn't matter that people read the bill. It's that Miley Cyrus is tweeting about it. It's that the environment looks bad. George Takei, who lost his man virginity in Indianapolis, I'll tell you that story in a little bit at the end of the podcast, is tweeting out that you shouldn't come to Indiana. So now it becomes a pariah effect. You don't want to associate with a pariah because you might become the pariah yourself.
Miley Cyrus, and Joe's the one who made me aware of this, Miley Cyrus, Mike Pence should never be on her radar.
Ever.
Never called him an asshole.
Yeah.
Publicly on Instagram. Right, Joe?
Absolutely. She's got more star power. And more people are going to hear her side of whatever she's saying than are going to hear his.
Joe, I know you got to go soon because we started late and we're running long. But so feel free to leave whenever you need to. But I want to give you a chance to jump in here before that happens.
No, I just think it's interesting, you know, Greg's his theory or his joke about everybody kind of vying for these social conservative votes. And it's an interesting thing to me because if you've got Rick Santorum, potentially somewhere out there in the peripheral, you've got Ted Cruz, socially conservative, and now he's the first one to announce that he is indeed running. Ben Carson, pretty conservative. He made the comment recently about, you know, homosexuality is a choice. Because if you were in prison and, you know, people are coming out of prison after having relationships in there and they come out and then they're gay or something like that. I don't remember exactly how I put it. But you've got those three. You've got Mike Pence and this whole thing. It's like who in the Republican Party that is a potential contender for 2016 is not vying for the social conservative votes? Is it just Paul, or is it maybe Paul, Christie, Jeb Bush, I guess?
No, I mean, Rand Paul is totally competing for those votes. I mean, look at how he speaks at any pro-Israel group he possibly can. You know, he came out saying he wants to increase defense spending. He is definitely trying to position himself as social conservative light, I guess I'd say.
Yeah, light, because it's in regards to some issues and not others that are important to social conservatives. But even if you lump him into that pot, what is going to happen? Are all of these guys going to kind of water down each other's campaigns for some time before the primary? And then that one candidate who's not vying for those votes somehow is the dark horse and sneaks into the nomination?
I don't know. I don't think that, you know, social conservatives, to me, I know they're not very powerful here in Indiana, not as much as they used to be. And so I have to extrapolate that nationally and think that, you know, the Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell coalitions of the world are, have eroded in power. And so why are these guys so powerful? I mean, the let's be honest, the majority of the Republican base is the 75-year-old grandmother with the straw hat with all the I Love Bush, Heart Reagan buttons all over their straw hat. They're the ones who stroke off the $250 a quarter checks to the various candidates and organizations. So that is a powerful voting block. But, you know, we're at a point where Glenn Beck comes out and says, I don't want government and marriage. We're at a point where Glenn Beck's people are showing up to our libertarian events agreeing with that statement. You know, Tea Partiers have fallen away from the idea of pushing gay marriage. And I just don't understand how powerful of a voting block they can be. I mean, I've heard it's as low as 20%.
Well, it depends on how you actually define it. Because if you look at where, like how Robe did, where it's the people who attend church once a week, then you're looking at over 40% of the voting block. And, you know, but that this is a different electorate than that was in 2000.
And those people are sitting here going, what is wrong with Mike Pence?
Oh, and that's what's hilarious. So I was looking at the news, the Washington Post.
Are you in the bathroom taking a poop or something?
I had to look up something because I thought I saw this headline. I wanted to make sure I got it right. So the leaders of the Christian church, the Disciples of Christ, were pressing Mike Pence to veto it.
Yeah, they're headquartered here in Indianapolis in downtown. Yeah, they're pushing for him to veto it.
So it's hard to say that, like, you know, that's how you know this was purely a political ploy. And this is what's going to happen. So this is going to be a recurring theme until the GOP and it may be all the way to the convention before they have the candidate.
Yeah.
It's just so split up and there's no one that's been able to organize people around it. But this is the race for the evangelical is going to define the political narrative for the next 12 months.
Yeah. Well, the problem is gerrymandering, because what gerrymandering has done to our electorate is it has polarized the electorate. So you don't get the Rockefeller Republicans fighting against the Goldwater Barry Goldwater. You get Ted Cruz fighting against Mike Pence.
Yes, <know? laughs> which is hilarious.
Right.
It's absolutely hilarious.
And it's done it to the left to the point that Barack Obama would be considered a communist in the 1950s.
I would not be shocked if there was a race among the GOP evangelical candidates to go and get ordained.
Yeah.
That is the point that we're at.
Let's be honest. Ted Cruz, and we'll probably get to him in a little bit, here's a guy who says that he stopped listening to rock music after 9/11 because they love Jesus and America more in country music. You know, it's just so flat out freaking ridiculous.
What's more funny about that is that he said that he used to listen to classic rock, but he stopped because he didn't like the stance they took on 9/11. Most of those guys are dead. He's classic rock.
Right.
Dead. I mean, how are they supposed to? I mean,
you know, I quit listening to the Beatles after 9/11.
Right. I mean, name a classic rock guy that is still in the public spotlight. Ted Nugent.
Seeger.
You know. I mean, and you don't hear his stance. I mean, so I don't know. So we've bashed Mike Pence and the Republicans. We've bashed the Christian business owner. Now let's bash the gay community.
Oh, God.
And then we'll end with a healing message. You know, I get offended a lot because I'm a sensitive little baby. And I can't say that I have white male privilege. There is no doubt about that. I can't relate to what Maya talks about, where Maya feels, or what Harry talks about, where you know that the person talking to you is filtering everything through, don't say anything offensive, don't say anything offensive, don't say anything. People don't talk to me like that. So
I make it a point not to talk to Harry like that.
Right. I never, you know, looking at Harry or Joe, I'm like, don't say anything offensive, don't say anything. So Harry, 12 years a slave. Neighbors. What did you think of Neighbors? So, I've never been on a date with a guy and had somebody look at me strangely, honestly, you know. So I can't say that I have been discriminated against. So I say that to say this. if I were in that situation, just being the person that I am, if I were told that I couldn't buy cookies from Just Cookies, I would put it on my Facebook that they would not sell me cookies, and then I'd go support another shop and promote that shop. I would not sue them. And now, to IUPUI's club's credit, they didn't do that. That's what they did. In Arizona, with the wedding photographers, they sued and are setting case law, which is what most things are judged by. I don't understand. I don't know for sure, but it feels to me like gay rights activists have said, we've won on gay marriage, now let's try this. Not all. A small, probably fringe minority of gay rights activist groups are saying, okay, let's find a squeaky clean gay couple that will go and will test Christian businesses until we get one, and then we'll produce case law. I don't understand that tactic at all.
Can that all be, like, I guess, pointed at the gay community, though? Because we already live in kind of an overly litigious society, and so then if we live in an overly litigious society and then these guys just happen to be gay in an overly litigious society, are they doing it because... Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, and what I'm trying to kind of clean this up and say that I don't think that it is the gay community. I think that there is a small section of activist groups that are trying to produce case law that will set precedents that Rosa Parks was absolutely right in what Rosa Parks did. She was writing a public system that was openly discriminating against people. Private businesses can discriminate all they want because that's the way that the American system has been set up. There is a big difference between private and public entities and how they treat people. Is it right for a Christian business to discriminate? That is up to the Christian business. They're the ones that make the investment in their business, and they're the ones that will profit or completely obliterate their investment, depending on the decisions that they make. It isn't the government's job to force any private entity to do anything because one group says this other group's wrong and we want to force our values on that group. So I guess I don't understand why a small segment of a certain community finds this to be something that is going to win people to their side. Because what has happened is you've won on, you know, highly activist groups have won on gay marriage, which people like me are all for. You know, if I don't want the government in marriage, but until we get to that point and can educate enough people, everyone should be married in any way they want and in an equal manner. Because that is the way that we as a society should be. But I don't understand then why you have to make people like me go, whoa, 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 whoa. You're going to start using the law to force people to do things that are against their values? Isn't that exactly what you were arguing against before? I mean, am I just totally crazy here? I mean, am I making any kind of sense, or am I sounding like a total asshole?
No, because, I mean, ultimately what you're talking about is that, and this is the culprit that never gets blamed in this, is that it is the government. Because in this scenario, government has accepted the idea of positive liberty, that there is some way you can make someone more free with the existence of government law and enforcement agencies. So right now, a company in Indiana may or may not be in violation of a Civil Rights Act or of Article 1 of the Indiana Constitution. So there's a need, an inherent need by these homosexual organizations to get more legislation passed so we can free people more. So I can free the gay community so that they, too, will be able to buy cookies at the cookie shop of their choice. And it's a dangerous line to walk down, because if you do it, my God, it's only a matter of time, because their entire argument rests on popular opinion. It doesn't rest on principle. So they're just hoping that they can get this lawsuit passed, and it'll all create a rising tide, much like the way gay marriage morphed and the way civil rights morphed, that it will become popular opinion that we can codify into law. That is so stupid. The right example for them to choose is for them to remove to eliminate laws like this. Once they don't want, unless they're just so angry, they really don't care that private businesses can choose not to sell them something. in my opinion. And if there is that inclination, then it is a grinding of there's just a total misrepresentation of what the state should do. The state should never be involved in settling disputes like this of discrimination. Unfortunately, that's a politically unpopular and public and horrible in public opinion, just like when Rand Paul talked about the Civil Rights Act with Rachel Maddow.
Yeah.
Private business.
You're trying to argue for discrimination and you're never going to look good.
You're never going to look good. So for like libertarians, for the way this is perceived in the press, the gay community, yes, they're Democrats, so they fundamentally and inherently have a different view of how the state should be used, so they're going to use it as a positive liberty platform. They are going to want to make sure that if any private industry tries to discriminate, there is going to be a legal remediation on behalf of the wrong consumer. That's what this is all about. Libertarians have to float such a just dangerous line, because it's like when you posted about it on Facebook, you had libertarians attacking you, you had Democrats attacking you, and you had Republicans attacking you.
But I also had all three of those groups supporting what
you
I said.
You did, and yeah. It is such a nuanced, and there's almost no insightful analysis of it, because you can never get anyone to get to the very premise, which is discrimination is going to be codified into law in Indiana because of government. Which, if I'm the gay community, I should take a really strong look at that and say, good Lord, instead of trying to fight them with government, I should be on the side of removing government and trying to eliminate government intervention in these types of encounters.
Right.
But you're never going to get anyone. It's such an emotional and hostile debate. But reason has no place.
But that's the problem with the debate. And so you become unmoored. We talked about this for an hour now.
Yeah.
And how can you have an hour-long discussion covering every aspect of all of the context of this particular issue, and we'll probably go on for another 5-10 minutes, how do you cover that and try and gain a perspective from all sides and say, here's where the right, here's where the wrong, here's the gray areas, when we live in a society where Maya coined the phrase the tyranny of the binary, where everything has to be black and white, good or evil, and in Maya's case, male or female, where you set these templates that everybody has to live up to, and if they don't live up to the social norms, then they're freaks, they're weird, they need to be cast out. You know, and what has happened, and I'll actually read my post here, because I think it encapsulates what we're trying to say shortly and succinctly. You know, it just, the problem with government is that government is force. It isn't voluntary associations. What brings people together is voluntary association. If you're a Christian business owner, you're probably going to have more success. Well, let me just read this thing, and then we'll talk about it, okay? Because it's real short. Posted yesterday, 9 a.m. No law can fix the heart. A law can't fix the capacity of an individual's ability to love their fellow man. Only voluntary exchanges do that. When we talk and work together to understand each other, the result is compassion and harmony. Using the force of government to bend others to your worldview leads to more division, more anger, and more hurt. Using the government, whether on the right or the left, to enforce your morality is wrong and a fool's errand. And that fundamentally is what libertarians believe. We don't believe in using the government to force other people to think the things that we think. Because as good of friends as Joe, Greg, and I are, we don't have the same lifestyles. We don't believe everything in the same way. We don't look at the world the same way, even though we're all very similar. We're different. What is right for me is not right for Joe, which is not right for Greg. And so it is up to us to live in a world where we can freely make choices and decide what is right for us, and Joe can decide what's right for him and his family, and Greg can make, you know, decide what's right for him and his partner. So, sorry. So, you know, that is...
Sell you a cake, Greg.
Yeah.
What'd you say?
I'm making Greg's cake.
Sell you a cake. It's okay.
As a Christian, I'm making Greg's cake for his wedding. And isn't that the loving thing to do?
And I'm dang, bro, I'll totally marry you.
See, and that's polygamy because Joe's already married to a woman. We've got gay polygamy going on here. It's great.
Not exactly what I meant, but yeah.
Oh, sure. Okay. All right.
Well, I would think that you would be more upset that it would be Lindsey Graham and his bachelor lifestyle than necessarily the cake.
I'm a very easygoing person. I don't get wigged out about much, except Mike Pence and Lindsey Graham. So fundamentally, I think libertarians look at this and they go, this could all just be avoided if we didn't try to use the government to force our morality and opinions on each other.
But then the left's going to hit you with, so then you support discrimination.
Yeah. And the right is going to hit you with, so you don't support the freedom of religion. You think that it's okay that a Quaker should go to war when they're drafted. You know, it is an awful and yet a beautiful place to be because you agree with everyone, but you don't agree with everyone. You're just different because you're just looking at the world from a totally different point of view. And I think when you do that, when you're that rare, weird animal in the middle of a debate where one side is shooting at the other side, and then you're in the middle going, I don't know what's your problem. Here's how we fix this. Everybody else goes, they're different. They're not just saying what Rush Limbaugh is saying or what Rachel Maddow is saying. They're saying something different. And I think by being different, that's how libertarians get noticed.
It's still messy, though. Because a libertarian would support a private industry not selling to a homosexual based on religious grounds.
Sure. And we'd also, yeah, it is called freedom of association.
It is. And
it's not discrimination.
It is.
It's not discrimination, although it is in the negative sense. In the positive sense, it's the freedom of association. I don't want to be associated with a Nazi cake store.
Right. And then you're hoping that in the libertarian position that the market eliminates that actor. Because you dislike it. Unfortunately, what I think is going to be the result of this, inevitably, is, I don't know if you'll remember when Chick-fil-A made their stance quite public on homosexual marriage.
Right.
There were lines for miles to go to Chick-fil-A's. It is like with Hobby Lobby in the Obamacare lawsuit. This, in the short run, is going to be much like the 2016 race. It's going to be a competition for consumers' dollars who believe like them, which is only going to antagonize. And we're looking at the 1960s race baiting, Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson. Instead of those individuals and this being about race, it's going to be about walking into a Chick-fil-A and not being served a breakfast biscuit because you're a homosexual.
But gay people work at Chick-fil-A. I mean, and I went to Chick-fil-A the other day, and that was clear. No, I'm just kidding. The problem with society is that people and individuals themselves, is they don't know who they are, what they believe. They want to be told what they ought to believe and what they should do and what they should think. And that is because of the growing dependence on the government. And it's not going to get any better as the government becomes bigger and more powerful, and we secede more of our own individual power to the government to tell us what we ought to think and do. You have to, listeners, start thinking about yourself as an individual and breaking yourself of the groupthink and the habit. Because if you never do that, you can never fully understand libertarianism.
And
doesn't matter how many Rothbard books you've read. If you can't grasp the concept that you are an individual and that you just have to understand what you believe before you can fully grasp these concepts.
And I feel like a lot of the mental anguish that libertarians suffer over this is that if you're a libertarian, you support voluntary association, and the logical extension and or application of that in this scenario is that you would support a Christian business owner not selling to an individual based on religious grounds. That I know that's hard to swallow for a lot of people. I know that really is, but lean into it, you know, embrace that because it does cause you some mental strife, but also know that it is a better position than the existing one of using government enabled in order to force people to do something.
Hashtag gay puns.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah. I just heard hard to swallow, lean into it, and better position, like all in the same thought.
You did.
Well, never mind. We've said too much here already. Okay, final thoughts on this issue before we do a little lightning round about other issues to fix those world problems.
No.
All right.
Crickets.
All right, we're going to do these things quickly. We're going to kind of run through the things that we wanted to talk about. Ted Cruz announced that he is running for president. A little bit surprising to me, well, at least to the me of 6 months ago. But if you had been reading the tea leaves, probably not surprising. Gentlemen, I don't really follow Ted Cruz. I don't really know much about him. I'll go first. I know that when he did that whole green eggs and ham thing, I was fairly impressed with his debate skills and his ability to give a speech. He certainly, I think, can be a people like Santorum and Huckabee. I don't think I'd have a shot against a guy like Ted Cruz because he's got that oratory ability that that is going to really help him in the debates if he can make it to that point. But what do you guys think of Ted Cruz? Let's start with Greg.
Okay. I see Ted Cruz differently than you. The one word that sums up Ted Cruz to me is abrasive, and as part of that, annoying. The more exposure you get to Ted Cruz, the less you like him. The more he is seen in the press, the more he has to go on and do public appearances. He has a natural unlikability.
Really?
It is grinding. It's really hard for me to put into words, but I think you're going to notice it the more exposure you get to him.
Yeah, because I have very little. I just don't.
He has a Rick Santorum quality about it, and where he comes off as whiny.
Okay.
So he comes off as whiny. He comes off as almost a conservative, like, justice warrior.
Ooh.
He's always that individual that's looking out at society in a way he's been wronged in his conservative principles.
Okay.
So whereas I see Mike Huckabee totally different. I see Mike Huckabee as Ted Cruz, only way more socially conservative, but he does it in a way you don't hate him.
I once liked Mike Huckabee a lot in 2007 and was very impressed with him because of the fair tax. At the time, I was a fair taxer. I met him in person at a local... he stopped here in town and shook the hand of every press member of the room. I was the only one he didn't shake their hand because he couldn't get to me. And just made sure that, like, how you doing? Sorry I couldn't get over there. You're a good dude, blah, blah, blah. And then he gave a great speech and is a very likable person. And I, at the time, Fred Thompson was the soup du jour. And I said, watch Huckabee. He's going to skyrocket. He went on to win Iowa.
Which makes him dangerous because he could win Iowa again.
Yeah. But the problem is he has said some stuff that is like crazy paternalistic. Like he's kind of exposed himself as the paternalist that he is. He wants to take care of you and plan your life for you. He is likable, but I think he's a known quantity at this point.
He is, but he outred meets the social conservatives than Ted Cruz. Okay. So he outred meets them, and he does it in a better fashion. It's that thing where, like, Santorum won Iowa. So he beat Mitt Romney by, 300 votes in that recount. But with Iowa, if Mike Huckabee gets national exposure and comes out of Iowa and wins, he's just got that Joe Sixpack likability, even though he is way more paternalistic than a Ted Cruz, who is he's a true Austrian economist type of individual. So he's kind of a conundrum in that you just absolutely love him on certain things, like with Rand Paul and the drone strikes. Then he talks about Russia and Putin and presenting a strong force in opposition to keep him in check, and so he's got hawkishness. He's just really a
Yeah.
But ultimately, none of that's going to matter because we all know that policy really doesn't drive the debates. What drives the debates is you look at somebody, you're able to process them, and they just have something, an aura that you just can't get behind.
Yeah, and let's not forget he was born in Canada.
Yeah, he was.
So his parents may have both been citizens, and he may be an American citizen, but... he was born in the Great White North. He can't be trusted. Joe, he's also Guatemalan like you. Are you going to support him?
Is that right?
Yeah, he's Guatemalan, just like you.
Yeah, I'll just kind of, I guess, say that there's probably a group of people who feels very strongly opposite of how Greg feels about Ted Cruz because, and I don't know if you guys know this, but when he announced at Liberty University, which I thought was kind of a smart little political tactic, he raised $1 million in the first day. And since he's made that announcement and given that speech, he's raised over $2 million. So there's already a nice little chunk of change behind him and his campaign. And I think that obviously means that there's a group of people who are pretty fiery and pretty passionate about seeing Ted Cruz become the next president.
The one thing I would, if you know, the hardest thing about the entire GOP primary, too, is Jeb Bush's fundraising network, which is the most incredible fundraising network to my knowledge. I mean, outside of Barack Obama and his ability to generate the micro contributions, right now Jeb Bush is having his donors, he's telling them, please don't make it for more than $1 million. Is that not incredible? He has over $30 million in the bank already.
Wow.
Well, he knows that everybody's taking, like, dipping into their pensions and, like, their AARP accounts down there. And so he's worried that they're going to, like, overextend themselves and not be able to survive. So he's just being a good Samaritan.
Oh, yeah. That sounds a lot like Jeb, huh?
Right. Lockbox. So I don't want to get into Rand Paul because I feel like
I got to get going.
Okay.
But I will say that Cruz, the media is kind of already working against him to create that narrative or shape that negative perception about him. You know, there's an article today that was released, I think, Washington Times, New York, Washington Post, New York Times, probably both put something about it. But he made a comment like he was Galileo.
Yes.
About to be Galileo because he made a global warming comment about.
He called the people that believe in climate change. Which I do love this. He trolled them. He called them flat earthers.
Flat earthers, right?
Oh, yeah. No.
That's awesome, by the way.
He is a total troll.
So, like, there are those elements you like him. It's just that he's one of those guys, the more you're exposed to him, the less you're going to like him because he's got a mullet. He whines.
Yeah.
He does this. Mullet?
He's got a mullet.
Oh.
When you hear him talk for extended periods of time, he does this. Watch it. He does this very odd thing where he looks up and to the right all the time.
Hmm.
It's kind of like how the president used to, like, manually look from side to side. He does this, like, almost looks like he could burst into tears at any moment.
He's staring at the vision of Reagan and Jesus holding hands right off to the right of the stage.
Riding dinosaurs with lasers.
Well, Joe, we've loved having you on.
Thank you.
And you should come on more. It isn't too hard to set up the board now that we've got it going again. It's been a while since we've used the old Skype machine.
It's finding the time. It is, like, the most difficult thing between the three of our schedules. But, yes, I would love to come on more, and I really enjoyed being on with you guys today. It was good talking to you.
Joe, how excited were you about that discovery of that lost city in Honduras?
Any truth to the rumor that that's where your ancestors are from?
I'm going to go cook some dinner now.
Are you making
Puerto Rican classics? Which one are you doing? Fried plantains?
I'm doing a refined cordon bleu tonight.
Oh, going French.
Yes.
Are you putting salsa on it? Joe,
everybody knows jalapenos go on cordon bleu.
What's this cheese? Oh, it's pepper jack.
I hope that you guys send hate mail to Spangle and Greg after.
Oh, I'm so sorry, buddy.
No.
I'm sticking my watchdogs on you.
Joe is half Puerto Rican, and we tease because we love. All right. Well, you have a good day.
Have a good weekend, buddy.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, I feel like we need to give Rand Paul. Whoa! All right. I feel like we need to give Rand Paul his own episode, and one when Creighton is here to defend his bro. The prom king of Liberty had a doctor's appointment, had to go get checkup. I think it was because I told him that if he wanted to come podcast, he was skins. He didn't want to do it.
No.
He wussed out. But Rand's a complicated issue, one that needs much more time than the little bit we're giving here. Hillary is expected to announce probably before the next time we podcast, same with Rand Paul. So you're going to start seeing everybody getting into the race. And I think a late entrance to the race is going to be, like Mike Pence, I don't know how he gets into the race right now, but, you know, he really screwed the pooch.
Now's the time, except he just bungled it.
Yeah.
Like, you sign this bill, you leap in Iowa and go talk at the families for, you know, Family Value Association dinner, and you springboard. And, God, he's just for a guy that's a politician, he has a total misread on how things are portrayed.
Crashed and burned spectacularly. Okay, so next subject. What else?
The big things in the world are... Middle East focused. The economy is something that's not being talked about, but it's huge. For the first time in that I have seen, we are actually seeing like retail sales growth and no wage growth.
Okay.
Which would be to me a very strong signal that we're about to, unless the Federal Reserve continues quantitative easing and propping things up, we're going to see a recession. Now, the Federal Reserve's released a lot of information that, because it was such a harsh winter, that a lot of these projections and forecasts are off. But Americans and globally, we're about to see savings prioritize consumption, and we're starting to see it right now, which in the short term is a bad thing because you're going to see a recession effect. In the long term, it's a great thing because you're going to see investment and capital accumulation.
Libertarians, specifically Austrian economic types, like to see more savings and money being saved.
And that's just economics, period, should want to see more savings.
Right. But the economic lords of the Fed like to see more spending and more capital going out into the world, because then that means that more money is flowing and more goods are being being attained, because the Fed used to be in charge of the monetary supply and making sure that things didn't get overinflated. Then, somewhere in the 70s, with Bretton Woods II, they were put in charge of making sure that there was
full employment.
And so, that dual role, it doesn't work. They conflict. It's not something that can really be achieved. So, you want money flowing in the economy, because that means full employment, because the more money you're spending at Best Buy, the more people in blue shirts can be employed. But you want to keep interest... You want to keep inflation low. You want to keep money in the bank. So
because you got to keep having investment and expenditures and, you know, capital investment. So I would watch. We're starting to see a really, really weird economic period. Now, I could be wrong.
Hot.
Thank you. I could be wrong. There could be a period where we're seeing maybe it is bad data. But, you know, the stock market's raging. The tech economy is clearly in a bubble. You're just seeing too many acquisitions for too high a price with no revenue.
Oh, yeah. Any day Meerkat's going to go for $20 billion.
Yeah. I mean, I still would debate whether or not Instagram was worth $1 billion, and yet, you know.
Snapchat. I mean, there's a company that you have never heard of, and it's called, what is it, the Spark? What's the chat thing that we talked about the other day? Slack.
Yeah.
Slack, I think it is. And Slack is this instant messaging service for companies where you sign up your company and you can chat with each other.
Now, see, they have over a million new contracts or a million in new contracts a week.
Sure. Okay.
So that is actual revenue.
All right.
But for instance, Yik Yak, which is like a it's geolocated Twitter anonymously.
Right.
Where you can like at Liberty U during the speech, people were mocking Ted Cruz anonymously, and you could like view it in real time, and it was hysterical.
Yeah,
that's a company that'll be a $1 billion company and maybe has 10,000 to 15,000 users and absolutely no revenue at all.
Right,
that's a bubble company.
Right,
yeah. So watch that, because we haven't talked a lot about the economy lately. And there hasn't been a lot of economic news, but we're seeing really odd things that are bubbling up. For instance, quite frankly, when you're not seeing any wage growth and you're seeing increasing sales and just stagnation from retail sales, what that tells me is that all the full-time jobs that were lost in the recession are coming back as part-time.
Right.
And they're also, they left the labor force at a drastically higher wage than they're being re-entered into. And so we're going to see stagnation for a good long time as these part-time workers are slowly moved into full-time positions and learning new skill sets, because some of it is structural, before we see any wage growth, which means all growth projections should be brought down.
Well, I've been listening to a lot of tech podcasts. I know you do as well. One of the questions that is being wrestled with in Silicon Valley is technological growth can't be slowed. It's Moore's law. We've lit the spark and the fire is burning, and you know, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, robotics are going to play an even more significant part of our role in the world. And so what are we going to do when we're at 50% unemployment? You know, they're talking about numbers between 20 and 50% unemployment.
What is it when a job becomes maybe just the possession of a job instead of welfare benefits, instead of XYZ, becomes a purely vanity appointment?
Mm-hmm.
That's a different political philosophy than even exists at this point on this earth.
You're looking at Egypt, where it's 50% unemployment and it's young males sitting on the streets, and then that's how riots start.
Yep,
and
so
the world gets turned upside down.
Well, yeah, and so like we're waiting for a philosophical breakthrough. Of it's time to consider, in the event that the majority of the economy becomes automated, and the creative economy is obviously going to be limited, just because it'll take a long time for the economy to transition to that, where it's purely creative class.
Sure,
you may see a political philosophy arise where just labor, in the terms of self-worth, in the terms of social unrest, is looked at instead of a way for economic growth. It's looked at a way to like a WPA.
Hmm.
Just an assignment, so they have self-worth, so we can keep the consumer happy and we can stop political revolution.
So what you're saying is I need to start a social network or marry Mark Zuckerberg.
No, I'd start a social network before marrying Mark.
Dang it. Okay. Next issue, Yemen.
Yemen has exploded.
Yeah. What else is new?
Next
subject.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, so right now, what makes that so interesting is we're engaged with Iran in nuclear talks. We're trying to strike a nuclear deal. We are caving on every single issue. I don't know if you've heard that at all, but we have literally caved on every single issue, and people aren't sure why, especially the conservative press. The reason I believe is why is when the whole, is it Hothnani or Hothani? Rebels, the Iranian-backed rebels,
Gesundheit.
They stormed a U.S. intelligence operative center, military center, and got basically our foundational counterintelligence network in all of the Middle East and how we operate.
In Yemen.
In Yemen, they handed it to the Iranian leadership. So the Iranian leadership right now is negotiating with the United States in Lausanne, Switzerland, and they know who our spies are. They know how we fundraise and what we do to propagandize and generate social unrest.
Hmm.
And that's why you're seeing us cave, and John Kerry cave, on every single issue. Right now we're at the point where we're okay with them not having us inspect their current level of nuclear development.
Okay. When did this happen?
Yesterday.
Why did we have such a thing in Yemen? Why
That was our most strategic partner because of the port of Yemen and its effect on oil. So since that's been in revolution, the port of Yemen has such a great impact on oil flows out of the Middle East.
Yeah, but it's Yemen. You keep that in like Switzerland or something.
Oh, no, well, yeah. Well, that was seen. Barack Obama promoted that Yemen as like the one example of the Arab Spring turning into a democratic republic.
Uh-huh.
You know, and then that idea of domino theory for democracy would spread across the Middle East, which is an illusion, clearly. And so now Iran is scaring Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia announced last night that they are going to pursue nuclear weapons.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
The world is going to hell in a handbasket in the Middle East. You're seeing a Saudi Arabian Israeli, I mean, just incredible. To imagine a Saudi Arabian-Israeli partnership, and Israel supports Assad.
Yeah.
we had a democratically elected government in Egypt that was turned out to be Muslim Brotherhood, and the United States supported a military coup overthrow, and now the president won't take calls from not even the president of Egypt, because that would be way too much. I mean, there was never an election. He won't take the calls of the Egyptian president. It's just... So they're having to use Bibi Netanyahu, has no relationship with President Obama, as the go-between. It's just incredible.
That's going well.
It is the most interesting time, and not interesting because it could lead to World War III, mm-hmm. but it is the most unbelievable time in history that you could see an American, I believe, we very real could see an American Al-Qaeda Saudi Arabia and Israeli and probably Assad Syrian alliance against Putin, who props up Assad, Iran, ISIS, who's helping us. The Iranians are helping us fight ISIS in Iraq. It's just, it's the most awkward group of allegiances I've ever seen in history.
It is the flying spaghetti monster of deals. I tweeted this out at Chris Spangle. I retweeted it. It's from Greg Carlstrom. I found it on Glenn Greenwald's Twitter. U.S. praises U.S. ally for bombing U.S. equipped militia aligned with U.S. foe who is partnering with U.S. to fight another U.S. equipped militia. I mean, it's just, oh, it's so bizarre. It's like,
we lost $500 million of military equipment in Yemen because we had to pull everybody out. We have no contact and no idea where it is. So we're not sure if Al-Qaeda in Yemen has it, or we're not sure if the Houthani, who are aligned with Iran, has it.
So you're telling me that we kept our most sensitive
military documents
in Yemen, and there wasn't a pull this lever and this whole thing will blow up in 5 minutes button.
I am.
Whose idea was this? Was this?
Well, we propped up their democratically elected leader, and where they've seized is not. I mean, one, Yemen.
Yeah, I'm about to seize. I can't take this anymore.
I know.
It's awful.
Israel, and then we also, for the first time in history, back last week, we declassified the exact level of development of the Israeli nuclear infrastructure as retaliation against them spying on us during the Congress. You know, when it is just the world we live in. We're supposedly negotiating with Iran on nuclear talks, even though we support Saudi Arabia, who doesn't want Iran to rise, and yet we're using and creating the airspace for the Quds, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, to fight ISIS in Iraq. And we just spent all this money deposing Saddam Hussein, and the most cohesive forces are the Iranian militias and that Uber warrior I was telling you about.
Yeah.
And then the Peshmerga, the Kurdish military, who don't really want to advance beyond their borders that they consider, so they're kind of done fighting ISIS unless ISIS encroaches on them. And then Iran is helping us fight ISIS, but then they just had a coup in Yemen and are scaring the hell of the Saudi Arabians, who are our biggest ally.
It'd be nice if we just pulled out and didn't participate, because it sounds like we're electing people like Mike Pence president of the United States.
Yeah.
All right. Any other topics? I feel like that was all the topics we wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I think that would cover it. Was it anything on Hillary?
The email scandal is just...
It continues to leak and be awful.
Okay, final thoughts for this episode?
No, I'm good.
I am currently enjoying the battle, the little bitch fight that is happening between Grover Norquist and Glenn Beck. Now, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I tuned into Glenn Beck and I heard a guy named Frank Gaffney, who does or has written for National Review and a bunch of other conservative sites. And he has long been a thorn in the side of Grover Norquist, a guy who is... I have a book called The Gang of Five, and it's about, you know, guys like Ralph Reed and David McIntosh and Grover Norquist and Karl Rove and these guys who have been around forever and have kind of been the network that has put together the conservative movement since the 80s and basically run the conservative movement in the Republican Party. Everybody wants to think that Rush Limbaugh is in charge of the Republican Party. It's guys like Grover Norquist and Ralph Reed and some of these other guys, and on the you know, funded by the Koch brothers, Cheryl Atkinson or whatever his name is out in Cheryl, what's his face? What's the dude out in Nevada that everybody?
Sheldon
gets,
Adelson.
Yeah,
that goes, he's the guy that owns Las Vegas Sands Corp.
Now, you know, and then they listen to Grover and these other guys and fund what they want, and then on the flip side, you've got guys like George Soros, Al Gore, who are the money men for people like not Leon Panetta necessarily, but who's the other cap? The Culture for American Progress or Center for American Progress.
Are you talking about John Podesta?
John Podesta, guys like that. and Van Jones, as Glenn Beck famously railed against. And so Glenn Beck kind of started looking into Grover Norquist and discovered the networks on the right. And Grover Norquist has connections to the Muslim Brotherhood. Well, that sent Glenn Beck off. And so Glenn has spent 2 or 3 weeks just railing against Grover Norquist. And Norquist, to his credit, went on Glenn Beck's show last night, and then Beck went on his radio show and ripped him apart today. But it is an interesting little exercise. You can kind of recap it all if you want to go back and listen to the Glenn Beck podcast and all that good jazz. But there's an interesting tidbit when I tuned in today. This is another little example of how this stuff works. Glenn Beck, for 2 or 3 years, I tune in occasionally just to kind of see what he's saying. And it was funny, when he went out to Silicon Valley a few weeks ago, he started talking like you and I, which is like, we don't need the government, we can have technology to take the place for all this stuff. And he started discovering technology. It was entertaining. So I'll tune in, and for several years now, Glenn Beck's been saying defund the GOP. It's time to pull out of the Republican Party. They're worthless. They're part of the problem. They're part of these networks that are the same as the Democrats. And defund the GOP, get out of the GOP. Nobody's paid attention to that because he's not on Fox News anymore. And so when he says it, his audience hears it, but it never shows up in the Huffington Post, the Daily Caller, Raw Story, National Review, all these other sites. So last week, he says it to somebody. I forget who. I wasn't listening. And all of a sudden, I see this story about how Glenn Beck is saying defund the GOP. And it was on all the liberal news sites. And it was like, see, the Republican Party is losing their spiritual base in the Glenn Beck audience. And all the conservative sites started attacking Glenn Beck, saying, you know, he's killing the conservative movement. He's a pariah. He's the John Birch Society. Get rid of this guy. And it is really weird to hear on today's Glenn Beck show where he said, Karl Rove went on Fox News last week and denounced me, saying I'm hurting the GOP. And isn't it weird that Karl Rove's Crossroads Group has given Grover Norquist $26, $29 million? You know? And so you see the power of Grover Norquist, where they just start calling up all their buddies and the New York Times and the media outlets and start going after somebody like Glenn Beck, who straight up doesn't care. Like, that's what I like about Glenn Beck, is that Glenn Beck is sort of like us in the regards that it's like, we're never going to run for office. We have our jobs. We like our jobs. We do this for fun. And we really don't, at the end of the day, remember what we say, let alone care about what we say. We're just saying what we think and what we've learned. And we're not trying to be Grover Norquist or power players or any of that kind of stuff.
No, because Grover Norquist is ultimately entirely dependent upon the Republican opinion.
The system, yes.
If he ever said what he thought, he'd be an insurance salesman in Ames, Iowa.
Right. So, you know, where a Glenn Beck says, here's what I think. Oh, I was wrong. My bad. You know? So I have enjoyed watching the dynamics of this because the most dangerous man inside of a system, like a political party, is somebody who doesn't care. When you are running for office and you just don't give a shit, you say things that nobody else says. When you're a libertarian and you don't care about Republicans or Democrats, I'm at a point where I don't care about politics and I don't care. I like all the people that I worked with. I like all the people that I worked against. I got along with everybody in the Indiana politics, but I'm at a point where I'm never going to be that politically involved again. I don't necessarily believe that politics is any answer to anything, so I'm just going to say what I think and what I believe. And that's the kind of mentality that scares somebody like a Grover Norquist.
Oh, yeah.
Or a Mike Pence, or, you know.
So they got to get out in front of it and crucify their credibility beforehand.
Right. So I just think it's a really kind of an interesting point that he's been saying this for years, and now all of a sudden it's a story. It's a topic, you know, and it's everywhere.
It's because it's dangerous.
Right. So, yeah, defund the GOP, that's not a good hashtag for Republicans at all. So
they've never been good at yeah. creating, you know. I mean, the only person that ever has that has any social media credibility is Rand Paul.
Right.
You know, that's because he's, you know, he gets it. He gets the dynamic and gets
Amash.
How important it is. Yeah, Amash.
And Massey, yeah.
Yeah, he's just not. Amash is more of a thinker than he is a politician.
Yeah. No, I like when Rand Paul trolls on Twitter.
Love it.
Great.
Love it.
All right, so this has been an episode of We Are Libertarians, episode 102. Thank you for joining us here on the episode. Please go to iTunes, rate us, give us 5 stars, or don't rate us at all. Leave a comment about how this is the greatest podcast in the world. It's way better than Joe Rogan's podcast. That's for Aaron Ewert.
Ewert.
This is way better than any other podcast in the entire world, not just other libertarian podcasts. What that does is that helps us get promoted to the front page of the podcast thingy, and it also raises our rank, and so we can go up in the news and politics category, and people may find us one day. Wouldn't it be cool for people to finally discover this podcast? You can be a part of it in supporting We Are Libertarians, so the show that you love so much. My cat is freaking out. There's something in the closet, like a dead mouse or something. She's like scratching on the door. So we got to end because I got to figure out if there's a body. Did you bring a body to my house?
I did.
All right, good.
But it's just Brett Bittner. It's no big deal. It's on ice.
Oh, nobody will miss him. All right, thanks for listening to this episode of We Are Libertarians. You are a beautiful person. And next time, we promise
to do better next time.
Is that not right?
What do
I do? Music for We Are Libertarians is provided by Hoosier musician Brian Keith Wallen. Please check out his website, briankeithwallen.com. The song is Bad Spell.